How can I say I love you? Let me count the ways. Probably all heard that saying. And this is actually a corruption of the first line of a famous love poem by the English poetess Elizabeth Barrett Browning. I think she was half English, half American actually. From a collection called Sonnets from the Portuguese. What a beautiful poetry there. I'm not really big on poetry, but this one, it was first published in 1850. I'm going to read it to you in its lovely entirety, in its short, poignant and flowery entirety. The words are lovely. How do I love thee? Let me count the ways. I love thee to the depth and breadth and height my soul can reach. When feeling out of sight for the ends of being and ideal grace, I love thee to the level of every day's most quiet need by sun and candlelight. I love thee freely as men strive for right. I love thee purely as they turn from praise. I love thee with the passion put to use in my old griefs and with my childhood's faith. I love thee with the love I seem to lose with my lost saints. I love thee with the breath, smiles, tears of all my life. And if God choose, I shall but love thee better after death. Oh, quite again, how can somebody put such beautiful words together? Well, the question I have today is, in how many ways can one person say, I love you, to another? In how many ways? On their wedding anniversary, a husband might give his wife a nice card, a nice gift, and perhaps some flowers, and he might take her out for a romantic dinner or a nice restaurant. And with these things and in these ways and by these means, he's saying, I love you. He's reminding his wife that he loves her. But our society, urged on by the greeting card industry and the florists and that kind of thing and other merchants, tries to tell us that it isn't enough for family members to declare their love for one another on wedding anniversaries or Mother's Days or Father's Days or whatever. We must, they tell us, do it all over again on St. Valentine's Day. But God's people answer no. The members of God's church do not observe Valentine's Day. I'm going to ask the question, why not? Why don't they? So the purpose of this sermon today is to explain to you the reasons why we in the Church of God do not observe Valentine's Day. It's coming up on, I know it's a couple of weeks away, in the middle of February, but it's the last opportunity I'll have to speak to you before then, so I thought I'd bring this to you today. So I'd like to go into this again. The purpose is to explain to you the reasons why we in the church do not observe Valentine's Day. And I'd like to do this by asking and answering five questions. And we'll go through them one by one. Okay, question number one then is, who was St. Valentine? Who was he? Now, I want to get out of the way first of all, the title saint. I want to tell you what a saint is. Because true saints are God's true people. That's the basic definition of it. The term saint can also refer to God's righteous angels. There's a few scriptures where good angels are mentioned as being his saints. But mainly the term refers to his people, human people. People of his people of today and his people of yesteryear as well. So we don't need a Vatican court case, for instance, presided over by Roman Catholic cardinals and priests in order to determine who is or is not a saint. God makes that decision. God, according to his perfect will, makes the determination as to whether or not a person has the Holy Spirit dwelling in him or her. Whether that person has a true love for God, and whether that person has been predestinated, called, justified, and conformed to being a brother or a sister of Jesus Christ. And all of these things are mentioned in Romans chapter 8. Let's turn there. Romans chapter 8. Romans chapter 8 and verse 26. Likewise, the Spirit also helps our infirmities or weaknesses, for we know not what we should pray for as we ought. But the Spirit, the Holy Spirit itself, makes intercession for us with groanings which cannot be uttered. And he that searches the hearts knows what is the mind of the Spirit, because he, that's the one who searches the hearts, in other words, God, makes intercession for the saints, here we are, the saints according to the will of God. The will of God. And we know that all things work together for good to them that love God. The saints are the ones that love God. And to them who are called according to his purpose. The saints are the ones who are called according to God's purpose. For whom he did foreknow, he also did predestinate, there's that part of it, he predestinated us way back in antiquity to be conformed to the image of his son. To be conformed to the image of his son, that he might be the firstborn among many brethren. Moreover, whom he did predestinate, them he also called, and whom he called, them he also justified, and whom he justified, them he also glorified. So, for example, we read in the Bible of Peter, Paul, James and John, for instance, and they were true saints. But we don't need to call them Saint Peter or Saint Paul or Saint James or Saint John, as is done, any more than I need to call you Saint Eric or Saint Angela or Saint Robert or Saint Kim. You know, we don't do that. Let's go back to Valentine again. St. Alex back there. let's go back to Valentine. Valentine was a very popular name amongst the so-called saints of yesteryear. And there was a considerable number of so-called saints by that name. It was a popular name for so-called saints. But the two most famous saints, Valentine or St. Valentine's, and yes, plural, were two men, both claiming to be, or both claimed by the Roman Catholic Church to be martyrs, and both of their festivals fall on February the 14th. So that's right, there were two Saint Valentines, or two Saints Valentine. I didn't know that before, but these two men apparently had a surprisingly lot of things in common. One was a Roman priest, and the other was a bishop, Bishop of Terni, which is a town, small town in central Italy. They both lived around the same time, around the second half of the 3rd century AD. We're going way back there. And they're said to have both died on the same day. There's a lot of coincidences here. They're both said to have died on the same day, and they were both buried, supposedly buried on the same street, the Via Flaminia in Rome. Now don't ask me why they weren't buried in cemeteries like civilized saints were, but this is what the encyclopedias tell us. So we ask the question, were these just coincidence, or were these two characters actually one and the same man? We really don't know, and the truth about them has disappeared in the fog of time, except for the setting of their feast day. Now, again, except for the setting of their feast day, there's absolutely no indication at all why either of these men are connected with love and romance. And if you think about it, that's probably as it should be, as long as they were behaving themselves, as all priests and bishops of the Roman Church are supposed to behave themselves. But in a nutshell, that is about all we know about the two St. Valentines, and it's not very much. Let's go on to our second question. What are the real origins of the celebration of this day? What are the real? That goes, takes us back to the 3rd century, what we just read. But here, as going back as far as documented history goes, we can trace a mid-February celebration back to two ancient Roman fertility festivals. And the lesser one known, is on, it was on February the 13th. It's called the Faunalia, F-A-U-N-A-L-I-A, and that was in honor of the god, the pagan god Faunus. And the better one known, on February the 15th was called a Lupercalia, L-U-P-E-R-C-A-L-I-A, and that was honoring the god Lupercus, or Lupercus. Now, we saw a similarity between the two St. Valentines, and there's also some similarity between Faunus and Lupercus, and they are considered to be closely related. And again, they're even thought by some historians to be one and the same god, small g, of course. And they're named differently by ancient Italians living in different regions, so they could be looked upon as the same god and just have a different name because of the different regions. You have to remember that Europe used to be carved up to between city-states. It wasn't a whole nation until quite recently. Okay, the main center of the Lupercalia celebrations was in Rome at a cave of the Lupercal is in Rome on the Palatine Hill in central Rome, and that's the cave where Romulus and Remus, if you remember, you go back to your history lessons at school, then Romulus and Remus were the legendary founders of Rome, who were supposedly nursed and brought up in this cave by a she-wolf. Okay, so now the Greek word for wolf is Lukos, L-U-K-O-S, and the Latin name for a grey wolf is the Canis lupus, hence Lupercal, Lupercus, and Lupercalia. So some traditions even say that Romulus and Remus instituted the feast of the Lupercalia. Now, I don't have time today to go into all of the details of the many strange fertility rituals that were performed on the Lupercalia and Faunalia, but I really must mention these two. The first one is that they had two young priests, okay, these were pagan priests, of course, and they ran either naked or almost naked around the city walls, okay, of Rome. And you have to remember, this is in mid-February, and Rome is a little bit warmer than what we're used to, but really mid-February, not that much. And they ran around the city walls, and they slapped any bystanders they met, and they had thongs which had been cut from animals that had been sacrificed earlier. So they go around smacking people with these thongs, and if you were smacked by one of these thongs, that was supposed to cure sterility if you were that way afflicted. Okay, that was one of the bizarre rituals. Another one is that they had a purification ceremony. I want you to remember this, because this comes up later as well. A purification ceremony was held during this feast of Lupercalia, at which Roman women were purified by the priests of the god Pan Lysias, also known as Apollo. Now, don't ask me how that purification was accomplished, because I don't want to go into those details. But there was a purification ceremony anyway. Okay, question number 3. How was the Lupercalia and the Faunalia transformed into St. Valentine's Day? Okay. Lupercalia was a very important event to the Romans, and Fornalia was very important to other Italians. They were regarded as the oldest Roman festivals, and along with the Saturnalia that we talked about a couple of weeks ago with regards to Christmas, they were amongst the most important. So in Rome, the Lupercalia and the Saturnalia were the big celebrations of the year. The importance of the Lupercalia is borne out by the fact that, listen to this now, the primary function of two of the most prominent families in Rome, in the nobility of Rome, and they were called the Fabius and Quintilius families, never heard of them before, and they were to organize the activities for the annual Lupercalia festival. Now these are high up guys. The modern parallel of this would be the Canadian Prime Minister, for instance, dedicating two of his top cabinet ministers and all of their families and all of their staff to organize an annual St. Valentine's Day celebration. Now that sounds ridiculous to us today, but that's how important Lupercalia was to the ancient Romans. They believed that stuff. So what happened with the arrival of Christianity in Rome? Lupercalia did not stop. It was firmly entrenched. It was so popular and it was so firmly entrenched that they wouldn't give it up. And this is a short quote from Encyclopedia Britannica. It says, "The annual celebration of the Lupercalia went on until AD 494, when it was changed by Pope Gelasius I into, get this, the Feast of the Purification." Now please remember that one of Lupercalia's major rituals was the purification of the Roman women by the priests of Pan Lysias. Okay, so now here in 494 AD, well into the so-called Christian era, a supposedly leading worshipper of Jesus, the Pope, was substituting his interpretation of God's post-pregnancy purification ceremony and actually changing it into a direct replacement for a heathen one. Okay, I want to just take you quickly through a couple of scriptures that talk about the God's purification ceremony in Leviticus and in the New Testament, just briefly, just so you can see the timing of it, the way the timing works out and the way it was all shifted around hundreds of years ago. Please turn to Leviticus chapter 12 verse 1. "And the Lord spoke unto Moses, saying, Speak unto the children of Israel, saying, If a woman has conceived seed and born a man-child, then she shall be unclean 7 days according to the days of the separation. For her infirmity shall she be unclean. And in the eighth day, the flesh of his foreskin shall be circumcised. And she then," the mother, "shall then continue in the blood of their purifying 33 days. Okay. She shall, and this could be symbolic, "and shall touch no hallowed thing, nor come into the sanctuary until the days of their purifying be fulfilled. But if she bear a maid child, then she shall be unclean 2 weeks, as in a separation, and she shall continue in the blood of their purifying 66 days. That's 66 days. "And when the days of their purifying are fulfilled, for a son or for a daughter, she shall bring a lamb of the first year for a burnt offering, and a young pigeon or a turtle dove for a sin offering unto the door of the tabernacle of the congregation, unto the priest. who shall offer it before the Lord and make an atonement for her, and she shall be cleansed from the issue of her blood. This is the law for her that has borne a male or a female. And if she be not able to bring a lamb, so if she was a little bit poor, then she shall bring two turtles, actually turtle doves, or two young pigeons, the one for the burnt offering and the other for a sin offering, and the priest shall make an atonement for her, and she shall be clean. So that, in the Old Testament time, was the proper way of purification. And all of the timings in there are probably good for the health of the mother and the baby, and also for the spiritual symbolism in there, which we don't have time to go to. Now, fast forward to the birth of Jesus. There's young Mary now, and Jesus has just been born. Let's go over to Luke chapter 2. Luke chapter 2 and verse 21. Luke 2:21. And when 8 days were accomplished, okay, so all of these days match what we just read. And when 8 days were accomplished for the circumcising of the child, his name was called Jesus, which was so named by the angel before he was conceived in the womb. And when the days of her purification, Mary's purification, according to the law of Moses, were accomplished, in other words, after 33 days, they brought him to Jerusalem to present him to the Lord. So it was actually, some people say 41 days and some people say 40 days after his birth, 8 days to for a circumcision, and saying, and then carrying that on another 33 days. They brought him to Jerusalem to present him to the Lord, as it is written in the law of the Lord, every male that opens the womb shall be called holy to the Lord, and to offer a sacrifice according to that which is said in the law of the Lord, a pair of turtle doves or two young pigeons. So they actually brought two turtle doves, which indicates there's a possibility that they weren't a very well-off family. Okay, now, in the early days of the false churches, the apostate churches, their feast of purification was kept on February the 14th. And it was kept on February the 14th because that was 40 days inclusive from their, what they call their Christ Mass, which was then held on January the 6th, back in those days. Now, Christmas is still today kept by some churches, the Armenian churches and some other churches, still on January the 6th. Now, later, most of the false churches changed these dates, the dates of their winter festivals, apparently to better coincide with their pagan counterparts. So Christmas was changed from January the 6th to coincide with Saturnalia, which was on December the 25th. And the Roman Catholic Feast of Purification was changed to February the 2nd, then, which was 40 days after their new Christmas Day. I'm not going to have a test, so you don't have to remember all these facts. But this is the way all of these dates fit in, and this is how this is how Valentine's Day came to be. So this new date, February the 2nd now, was established as the Roman Catholics' Feast of Purification in 542 AD by the Emperor Justinian, and today it's alternately called Candlemas. Now, it may or may not be significant, but it seems too much, to me it seems too much of a coincidence not to be. Well, February the 2nd, in our day and age, is a very prominent day in witchcraft practices around the world. Okay, now, so January the 6th now became the Roman Catholic and Church of England Feast of Epiphany. And that's supposed to be when the Magi were supposed to have arrived from in Bethlehem from the eastern lands to worship the young Jesus. So now we have a gap. So they'd moved the Feast of Purification from February the 14th back to February the 2nd. So now they had a gap between, they had Epiphany, they had the Feast of the Purification, and they had a gap up until Easter, okay? So they wanted to bridge that gap. And so they came up with the dedication of February the 14th, then you have to fill in that day with something. The Roman Catholics, if you don't know or not, they have every day of the year is dedicated to a certain saint, right? And they actually ran out of days with the 365 days. They ran out of days, and so November the 1st is All Saints Day, you know, to fill in for any that they didn't have time for. Anyway, that's beside the point. Okay, so the gap between Epiphany and Easter then was bridged by the Christianization of Lupercalia through the dedication of February the 14th to St. Valentine. Okay, next question. Question number 4. And this is the important one. What does God think about it? What does God think about it? We probably, you know, it was a big deal to the Romans, and to a certain extent it's probably a big deal to the Roman Catholics. But what does God think about it? That's the important thing. There are, in the Bible, literally hundreds of warnings in both the Old Testament and New Testament cautioning God's people to stick to his ways and his laws and his feasts, and to stay well away from the pagan ways of the world that are still around us today. We're still, you know, we think that the world is not, you know, that it's very physical and very, you know, that it's not very spiritual anymore. But still, a lot of those things that they came up with thousands of years ago are still around. They haven't gone away. Okay. Let's just have a look at a couple of these warnings. Now, we read some when we were looking at New Year's and when we were looking at Christmas. We went through them, but we have another one here that's very important. Exodus chapter 34. Exodus chapter 34. Exodus chapter 34 and verse 12. Take heed to yourself, lest you make a covenant with the inhabitants of the land where you are going, lest it be for a snare in the midst of you. So he was giving them advance warning of what was going to happen when they headed into the promised land. Verse 13. But you shall destroy all their altars, break their images, and cut down their groves. For you shall worship no other god, for the Lord, whose name is Jealous, is a jealous God. Lest you make a covenant with the inhabitants of the land, and they go whoring after their gods, and do a sacrifice unto their gods, and one call you, get that, one call you, and you eat of his sacrifice, and you take of their daughters unto your sons, and please listen to these words, brethren, and you take of their daughters unto your sons, and their daughters go a-whoring after their gods, and make your sons go a-whoring after their gods. Now right after this warning from God, he sternly commands his people to keep his Sabbaths and his feasts. Verse 18. The Feast of Unleavened Bread, so it kind of rolls right into this. The Feast of Unleavened Bread shall you keep. 7 days you shall eat unleavened bread, as I commanded you, in the time of the month Abib. For in the month Abib you came out from Egypt. Jump down to verse 21. 6 days you shall work. God's commanding them, you shall work. But on the seventh day you shall rest. In earing time and in harvest you shall rest on the Sabbath day. And you shall observe the Feast of Weeks of the first fruits of the wheat harvest, we call it Pentecost, and the Feast of Ingathering, the fall feast at the year's end. Three times in the year shall all your men, children, appear before the Lord God, the God of Israel. Okay. God gives them those stern warnings, follows it up by a reminder, these are my holy days, these are my Sabbaths, you better keep them. And we ask the question, did the Israelites heed and obey what he said? Did they heed the warnings? Okay, let's go over to Numbers, and we're going to read what they did shortly after this, and shortly before they arrived in the Promised Land. Numbers chapter 25, and just start with the second half of verse 1. And the people began to commit whoredom with the daughters of Moab. They just, not long before that, they'd just been warned not to to team up with those daughters, with those foreign daughters. And they, the Moabite women, called the people, the Israelite people, unto the sacrifices of their gods. And the people did eat and bowed down to their gods. The terminology, the wording here is virtually exactly the same as it was back in Exodus that we just read. And the people did eat and bow down to their gods, and Israel joined himself unto Baal Peor, and the anger of the Lord was kindled against Israel. And you bet it was kindled against Israel. Jump down to verse 5. And Moses said unto the judges of Israel, and he'd been told by God to pass this on, slay you every one his men that were joined unto Baal Peor. God took that very seriously, what they were doing there. And so the Bible is just full of this kind of warnings for God's children to stick to his ways and to avoid pagan ways, like we would avoid the plague or the flu. Now, if you need further convincing that what we've just read, all you've got to do is grab a Bible concordance or look online there and look up God's repeated warnings in all of the many scriptures. All you have to do is look up the word gods with a small g, and there's literally hundreds of them. I think I counted about 220, I think, when I looked it up. Probably there's no scripture in the whole Word of God that puts it in better words than Deuteronomy chapter 12. And again, I'm repeating this from our Christmas and New Year's sermons, but it is really hard-hitting. Let's read it again. Deuteronomy 12 and verse 29. When the Lord your God shall cut off the nations from before you, where you are going to possess them, and you succeed them and dwell in their land, take heed to yourself that you be not snared by following them, after they be destroyed from before you, and that you inquire not after their gods, saying, how did these nations serve their gods? Even so will I do likewise. You shall not do so unto the Lord your God. For every abomination to the Lord which he hates have they done unto their gods. For even their sons and their daughters have they burnt in the fire to their gods. Whatsoever thing I command you, observe to do it. You shall not add thereto, nor diminish from it. Okay, it's pretty clear. So now, how do we transfer this to ourselves? Question 5 then, what should we do about it? What should we do about it? So the scriptures, again, the scriptures, even the few scriptures that we've had time to read today, are quite clear. That God's people, both Old Testament and New Testament, including us in God's church today, should not be keeping any of the heathen celebrations, including Valentine's Day. As we just read in Exodus 34, God makes his alternatives, if you want to call them that, quite clear. We are to keep his Sabbath and his holy days, and we're to keep them with a smile on our face, with joy and with zeal. Again, with what we've just read there, the ancient Israelites were given the authority and responsibility to go into their new homeland in the land of Canaan and to tear down all the places of pagan worship. God commanded them to do that. Now, we don't have the authority or the responsibility to do that. We just have to make the best of living in the middle of a world, this world of thinly disguised paganism. Now, for most of us here, for most adults in God's church, Valentine's Day does not present much of a problem. In the unlikely event that somebody invites you to a Valentine's Day party, just say, no, not interested. But the ones who do have the most problem with the avoidance of Valentine's Day celebration are the children, and especially, I would say, the younger ones, the little ones. High school age children should be able to do the same as the adults, and most of them have been through it often enough that they know what to expect and how to avoid it. But for younger children, for the little ones, they cannot be expected to handle it on their own, and they need the parents' help. But, again, and I don't know whether these little ones are going to school yet, but keep this in mind perhaps for the future, and for anybody else who happens to listen to this sermon later on. What we have to be careful of, or what you parents, we've been through it already, all of this, and a long time ago, you have to be careful not to rely on the chatter that you had last September with the little guy's new grade 2 teacher, in which you told her in 2 short minutes all about the Feast of Trumpets, Day of Atonement, the Feast of Tabernacles, Halloween, Christmas, New Year's Day, April Fool's Day, Easter, Days of Unleavened Bread, and Pentecost. And, teacher gets blown away by that. Need to take extra time shortly before these kind of things, including Valentine's Day, to drop by the school and have another quiet talk with the teacher. And if you definitely can't get to the school to see their teacher in person, write them and send them a friendly little note of explanation. But be nice, because it's not the teacher's fault that she has not, say he or she, has not been called or chosen as we have. It's not the teacher's fault that she has not been given the knowledge that we've been given. And it's probably not the teacher's fault that the school's curriculum has been built around the world's pagan celebrations and holidays. So again, keep that in mind, parents, that they have not been given to understand these things as we have. And you have to remember also that it wasn't really too long ago that we were in the dark as far as these things were concerned as well. But brethren, we can be glad and we can be very thankful that we have been freed from the modern version of these old pagan holidays, and that now we can turn our attention and our energies to more effectively preparing for and keeping God's true holy days.